Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, as a child growing up in Miami in the 1950s and early 60s, I remember a lot of things about that vast, mysterious, wet country to our west called the Everglades. I remember the torrential rainstorms that would arrive almost like clockwork at 4 in the afternoon in the summer, last an hour and then give way to sunshine again. I remember clouds of mosquitoes that would descend literally like a fog as evening came on, especially if you were kind of out of town at all, so that you'd literally run for cover when they came down. And I remember the sky being orange for days and even weeks as the sawgrass and muck in the Everglades periodically caught fire and burned uncontrolled forever, it seemed like. And I remember exploring the edges of the glades in a canoe at around the age of 12. Probably no parents would let you do that today without being arrested. Then we were wild and free. And seeing untamed nature going about its business, right? Alligators and moccasins, orchids in the trees, and bobcats. I even saw a panther once. And I encountered a small Seminole Indian village, really just a family encampment, who tolerated my hanging around for a few hours. And it was wild country at my doorstep. Not that way anymore. My guest, Elliot Kleinberg, is a staff writer for the Palm Beach Post in South Florida, the author of 10 books on Florida, and is a longtime observer and commentator on all things Florida. In addition to his 3 decades at the Post, Elliot has also had a Palm Beach County history column for nearly 20 years and has a new Florida history column that will run statewide that debuted in early January. One of his books is titled Weird Florida. Need we say more? I mean, there's kind of a meme on the internet called Florida Man because so many bizarre things happen in Florida. People say, I didn't even need to read the story. I knew it happened in Florida. But today we're going to talk about what is probably the most prominent feature in all of Florida. Not Disney World, not South Beach, and not sunshine or hurricanes, but the Everglades. A book was recently written about its history called The Swamp, on which an episode of PBS's American Experience is based. The program will premiere on January 15th. The book, like the show, covers the history of man's efforts to tame the glades and turn it to productive economic uses, and in the process, gradually destroying it. Welcome, Elliot.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being on. I think we all know something about the Everglades, but why don't we start with a quick physical description of it? How big was it in the 19th century before we had succeeded in altering it much? And how much of Florida did it cover?
Well, I talk at length when I do talks around the state. I always tell people where you're standing probably was part of the Everglades. And also in my book, Black Cloud, which tells the history of the great 1928 hurricane, I talk about how the Everglades really started at the south shore of Lake Okeechobee and covered the entire peninsula all the way down. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas talks, of course, about a river of grass, and that's what it was. It was just a sheet of water that moved down the peninsula from the lake all the way down to Florida Bay, an amazing natural machine of water and rain and land.
What did it really consist of? I mean, it wasn't just water. What was growing? If you flew a drone over it at high speed, what would you have seen 100 years ago?
Well, it was an amazing ecosystem. I've heard people say that it's the only place in North America that looks the same as it did in prehistoric times. You had this water that sometimes was just knee-deep. You had every kind of mangrove, and you had palm trees growing on islands. You had alligators. You had many, many different types of birds, all working and living alongside each other, so to speak. Despite all that, the early settlers were convinced that it was a worthless swamp.
What I used to love, I mean, I used to hunt in the Everglades when I was a kid, and I'd explore around there, as I described, you know, without hunting, too. I always wished I had a camera, but I was too poor to afford one. But I used to love the hammocks, which were round humps, I guess, of limestone sticking up that grew cypress and palm trees and bushes that weren't necessarily sawgrass on them. And they were like little islands in the river, right, in the river of sawgrass. And they had a lot of wildlife in them. And in the middle, there was typically a little round pond. So it was like a little lagoon in the middle of the hammock. And that was one of the most interesting features of the glades to me. Do you know much about the big ditch effort in the 1880s? There was a guy named Hamilton Diston who basically, as you said, they viewed it as kind of a wasteland that needed to be converted to human economic use. So tell us about that.
Well, Diston was Philadelphia. He was a member of a large family that made the Diston saws, which you still probably hear the name. And he bought, I think it was about 15% of the entire state of Florida for, I think, a quarter an acre, most of which is now where Disney is. So you can imagine what it's worth now. And he had this idea to just run these waterways across the state for navigation and recreation, and in the process drain parts of the swamps to reclaim land. He didn't do too well financially. He ended up pretty much wiped out. But it was the first of many attempts that would come later to drain the Everglades, because people believed that if this swamp, which they saw as being of no value, was drained, it would expose the richest farm soil in America.
Mm. Yeah, and we'll get to that. It was muck, you know, but it was the product of millennia, you know, probably millions of years of sedimentation just sinking down and, you know, forming this rich soil. So you said that was the first effort to drain it. I think maybe the next one was a governor with a grandiose name of Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, for whom Broward County is named today. And in around, I think, about 1905, he resumed Diston's drainage plan, making it a state priority. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, in fact, it was his primary campaign promise. He said, let's drain these Everglades. He had this great line about how if you just punch a hole in the side of the limestone and all that water will go away and we'll have all this wonderful farming soil. We now know that, yes, a lot of that marvelous muck was exposed, and it is wonderful farming soil. But what people did not know at the beginning of the 20th century, or did not care to know, is that the muck eventually dries up and blows away. There is a pole outside a University of Florida Agricultural Extension Station out by Lake Okeechobee, where they've been marking the disappearance of the level of muck. It started several feet, and it's moving its way down. The muck is vanishing. A lot of people say, well, nobody knew at the time what the long-range environmental damage would be. But in fact, there were people. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who we talk about often in the history of Florida, her father, Frank Stoneman, was the editor of the Miami Herald and was writing editorials saying, we think this is a bad idea. We think this is going to mess up Florida's natural rain machine. But of course, people had stars in their eyes, or in this case, not stars, but dollar signs.
Mm. Yeah, so once you take away the water that covered that land, then the source of the enrichment of the soil disappears, right? So it just starts, it's a non-renewable resource. It's great at first, but the more you plant plants that suck on it, the more it goes away, and eventually it's gone. How did Broward's goal of draining it succeed, or how far did he get with that?
Well, you know, if you look at a map of Florida, there's these big, long canals that work their way down from Lake Okeechobee to the coast, you know, the New River, the Palm Beach Canal, the Hillsborough Canal. And in fact, when those canals were dug, all that water came rushing out of the Everglades and farmland was exposed. And you look back in we're now talking like the early 20th century, like 1910, 1915, 20. We know now that area south and east of Lake Okeechobee is now a huge sugar growing area. In fact, a gigantic fraction of all the sugar grown in America is grown in that area. I think it's 700,000 acres. Driven past it many times, and it's just amazing, the gigantic expanse of these sugar fields. People don't realize that it was not the sugar people in the beginning. In the beginning, it was mom-and-pop farmers who came in when they heard that the Everglades was being drained and that this farmland was going to be exposed. They came in, they grew peppers, they grew lettuce, they grew tomatoes, they grew all these winter vegetables. In fact, the joke was that if you were sitting in your house in New Jersey in January and you're eating a salad, it came from Palm Beach County, Florida.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing at the time. I've seen those cane fields myself, and yeah, it's like a taller version of the oceans of waving wheat out in Kansas or something. It kind of reminds you of that. You know, interesting sidelight, there was a woman in those early days, maybe in, I don't know, the late teens, early 20s, named May Mann Jennings, who was married to a prominent government official, a politician, I guess. And she was also then the president of the Florida Federation of Women's Clubs. So you'd think that would be somebody who was into, you know, gardening or beautification or whatever. But she was a very serious, strong-willed woman, and she got the whole Federation of Women's Clubs in Florida behind the idea of there was a place called Paradise Key that was not too far from Miami in the Everglades that was really unusual. It was higher elevation, and so it was like a piece of the Amazon in a way. It was very much a jungle. But it had huge royal palms. I mean, it was like a grove of royal palms, and these things are extremely stately and beautiful if you've ever seen them, you know, 100 feet tall or more sometimes. And she got an initiative going to save that from development because people were going to run a road in there and turn it into, you know, housing developments and cut out all the palms and so on. And she was able to get that made into Royal Palm State Park, which was the very beginning, like the leading edge of the wedge leading into what eventually became the Everglades National Park. And so May Mann Jennings kind of started the ball rolling in that direction. And that's something I didn't know until I was looking into this a little bit in preparation for the show. But the dredging of canals continued. I mean, my grandma arrived as a small child with her family in Miami in 1908, and it was still a frontier town with board sidewalks and mud streets and a population of about 2,000 at that time. I mean, it was kind of like the Wild West with palm trees. But the first Florida land boom started in 1911, only a few years after she got there. So why don't you talk about that some, Elliot?
Yeah, the Florida land boom, I used to say in my talks that it was an orgy of capitalism with resulting crash, the likes of which we'll never see again. And, of course, I was wrong.
Yeah.
So much of the Florida land boom really was a house of cards. It really was what we would call nowadays a pyramid scheme, because there was a huge run for people to invest in land in South Florida because they felt that this was going to become a major metropolis, which it did, and they wanted to get in at the beginning, you know, buy low, sell high. And so there was just a frenzy, and it wasn't just in Miami. It was in downtown West Palm Beach, where I am. It was in Fort Lauderdale. It was over in the Tampa area, not so much in the Orlando area, which really didn't get going until you-know-who came along, but Jacksonville, Daytona Beach. And what happened is these opportunists would come down and just buy up huge tracts of land and then hold auctions and sell them piecemeal. It was just a frenzy. I should also say that there were these guys called Binder Boys,
right,
who are some of the most colorful characters that I've ever encountered in my studies of the history of Florida. And these were just the retail-level opportunists. And these were guys who would come down, and they would live seven or eight to a room in hotels and flop houses in downtown Miami, downtown Lauderdale, downtown Miami, downtown Tampa. They'd go out on the sidewalk, and they'd be buying and selling this land sight unseen. All they would buy and sell is what was the 10% down payment, which was called the binder, which is where they got their names. And they made a ton of money. In fact, the joke was, it wasn't a joke, a piece of property could be bought and sold three or four times as it worked its way down the sidewalk to the courthouse to be stuck into that little clock thing. The way this thing all collapsed is that some people finally decided that they were tired of just buying and selling property sight unseen, and they decided that they actually wanted to start building on it, either their personal home or if they were a developer, they wanted to build a whole neighborhood. And that's when they discovered that some of this property was underwater or was inaccessible. And then the other thing that happened was that they discovered that while Florida was rich in natural resources, all of the places that made 2x4s and penny nails and bricks were in places like Cincinnati and Philadelphia, and there was no I-95, there was no FedEx, there was a slow boat from, you know, New Jersey. So they couldn't get the building materials, the processed building materials, down here fast enough, and then they had a few hurricanes you might have heard of.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little later. Yeah, it was a huge swindle. I mean, they were advertising, you know, full-page ads in the papers, you know, buy now before it's too late. And, you know, much of the land, as you say, that was being sold was literally underwater, but they weren't saying that. Those binder boys would actually be on the trains coming south from the big cities in the north and flipping these properties on the train, walking up and down the aisles. I mean, it was just crazy. It was like a speeded up, you know, version of what went on in the Great Recession of the middle 2000s. You know, with flipping houses, but these were just flipping contracts, as you say, and for property that no one even knew what it was. You know, so it was just crazy, and it was bound to bust, and it did bust. A couple of things caused that to happen, but let's talk about one thing that went on. Again, we're trying to do this a little chronologically toward the formation of the park. So, along with the drainage canals that were being dug, there was something called the Tamiami Trail. It was completed in 1926, and it took 13 years to do, so it was started in 1913. Talk about what that did to the glades, too. I mean, all these things were basically desecrating the glades as an ecosystem, right?
If we had had aerial views or views from space in 1911 or 1926, people might have got it. They might have said, oh, I see, because you can see that there's a natural flow of water. It starts all the way up in north central Florida, as far north almost as Ocala, where you have the Kissimmee River Valley, the Kissimmee floodplain. The source of water in Lake Okeechobee is not the rain falling directly over Lake Okeechobee, although Lake Okeechobee, of course, is enormous. It's 3/4 of the size of Rhode Island. But it's the water that falls across the Kissimmee River floodplain north of Lake Okeechobee. And all that water comes through and filters and gets into the Kissimmee River and some of the other rivers and flows into Lake Okeechobee. And then from there, before people came along and messed up this natural machine, the water would go through the lake, which was this rich ecosystem of plant and animal and fish and everything else. And then it would just ooze out of the south shore of the lake and down through this river of grass into this natural flow, went all the way to Florida Bay. Florida Bay was this perfectly balanced mix of brackish water where these wonderful little baby lobsters grew and had just the right combination of salt and fresh water to have these wonderful lobsters that we all like with butter. Mm-hmm. And everything worked great. There was this great machine. And the history of Florida, we all know, is that if there's a saying that you can use for the history of Florida, is that everything is great and someone comes along and messes it up.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you mess up this natural river of grass? Well, you block it.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing they did is they put a dike along the south shore of Lake Okeechobee because farmers were complaining that every time there was a rainstorm or a wind event, the water, but there was nothing, it was just a lake, there was a shore, and the water would just ooze out of the lake. Lake Okeechobee is no more than 20 feet deep at any point. So if you want to do a little experiment, go into your kitchen with a frying pan, fill it all the way to the top, and try to walk across your kitchen floor without splashing any. With no depth, there's no place to dissipate the water energy. That's why we've had rain events where the north shore of the lake can be 7, 8, 10 feet higher than the south shore. It just sloshes like a giant frying pan.
Hmm.
So every time that happened, the water would ooze out of the south shore of the lake. It would go down this natural flow through the Everglades, through the River of Grass, all the way down to Florida Bay. Okay, now let's put a dike along the south shore of Lake Okeechobee because the farmers are complaining. Then let's build this Tamiami Trail so that people can get over from Miami to Tampa, which is why it has the name. And, of course, we have to build it out of the swamp, so let's build this big roadbed. Oh, it's blocking the natural water flow. Yeah, but so what?
So they built a dam, basically, halfway down the Everglades. I remember driving on it in the mid-50s when it was already, 30 years old, but it seemed like a frontier experience to us because we had to stop sometimes and slowly drive around huge alligators. I mean, I'm talking 12, 13, 14-foot long alligators that were sunning themselves on the road. It was like a Tarzan movie, only, instead of the bank of the Nile, it was this road. And,
you'll still encounter that in places, which is kind of cool.
So we've talked about Lake Okeechobee, and you've mentioned hurricanes a couple times. So then all this frenetic real estate activity, this frantic buzzsaw of churning of properties and so on, draining the Everglades, all this kind of hope that we're going to make basically a half a state into a whole new kind of golden era of farming here. And then a hurricane happened in 1926. Tell us about that.
Well, if you wanted a horror movie, it would sort of be like, like Jaws music, except in this case, it would be hurricanes working their way across from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, people think sometimes that the weather gods space out hurricanes to cut people a break. Well, we all found that in 2004 when two hurricanes struck my area of Florida 3 weeks apart.
Mm-hmm.
But you should also consider that of the four most profound hurricanes to strike Florida in the 20th century, three of them happened 9 years apart and basically about 200 miles apart, which we all know in hurricane terms is not a lot.
Mm.
Those would be the 26 hurricane, the 28 hurricane, the 1935 Labor Day storm.
Right.
The fourth one, of course, being Hurricane Andrew in 1992. So first came the 1926 hurricane. And if you wanted to make an exclamation point on killing the Florida land boom, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Where did it hit? It hit downtown Miami. In fact, weather people and the Hurricane Center people have said that if Andrew had taken the path of the 1926 storm, instead of basically hitting the rural areas south of downtown Miami, it would have caused four times the damage that Andrew did.
Yeah.
And we all know what kind of damage Andrew did.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time the 1926 hurricane was done with Miami, even before the winds were dying down, all the opportunists were saying, okay, I'm done. And that was the last nail in the coffin. Well, it wasn't the last nail in the coffin. It was really the first nail in the coffin.
Right.
Nature wasn't done. In 1926, after this hurricane struck Miami, it moved up through the interior and struck a town called Moorhaven, which, if you consider the lake to be a clock, Moorhaven's at about 8 o'clock. And it's still not a very big town, but it went through there. And again, the state had built a dike around the lake, but it was a dike in only the loosest of terms. It was a 6-foot-high dike made out of muck, which basically might as well have been made out of Play-Doh.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really there to just keep the water from oozing out into the farms. It wasn't really there to protect the countryside from a major water event, from a hurricane, washing the water out of the lake. The 26 hurricane came up from Miami, hit the southwest corner of the lake, washed all the water out of the lake, drowned about 600 people in the town of Moorhaven, which is 600 is a lot of people when you're talking about a small town.
Mm-hmm.
So the state of Florida said, okay, let's have a committee. We need to either abandon the interior or we need to build a bigger dike. Well, they weren't going to do the first part because civilization never does the first part. So they said, let's build a bigger dike. they had a committee, and 2 years later, they were still arguing about it because Miami-Dade County said we are paying an disproportionate amount of the expense. You know, something's never changed.
Yeah.
So everybody said, well, you know, should we be hurrying up on this? And they said, no. What are the chances that another hurricane is going to strike Lake Okeechobee just 2 years from now? That was their big mistake. Which brings us to the 1928 hurricane, which is the most profound event in Palm Beach County where I live. To me, so profound that I decided to write a book about it called Black Cloud, which came out in 2003 during the 75th anniversary of the hurricane. I argue that the 1928 hurricane is the most underreported natural disaster in the history of the United States. It's the second highest loss of life of any hurricane in U.S. history, second only to the Great Galveston hurricane. It drowned as many as 3,000 people just in Florida, and it's the reason why, and it really changed completely the way we manage Lake Okeechobee, and yet most people have never, ever heard of it. Now, one of the big reasons why most people have never heard of it is that I say in my book that if it had drowned 3,000 white businessmen in downtown West Palm Beach, or if it would have smashed a black tie affair out at Mar-a-Lago, people would still be talking about it. Actually, Mar-a-Lago wasn't there yet, but you get the idea. But it mostly killed poor black migrant workers who had come to the Glades to work the fields from either the Deep South or the Caribbean. And in the 1920s, these people were invisible. They weren't just second-class citizens. They were invisible.
Right.
And so when the hurricane came, they had nowhere to run. They had nowhere to go. So the hurricane came through. It struck West Palm Beach. It moved across the interior. It came up basically because people always say, well, if the hurricane was coming from the coast, how did it wash all the water out of the lake to the east? And, of course, we know that a hurricane is a gigantic cyclone. So it came to the north end of the lake, and it pushed all that wind down from the north to the south. And so here you had all this water, and it got pushed to the southeast corner of Lake Okeechobee, the only place where there was a substantial population. And all that was blocking it from the countryside was this 6-foot muck dike, which lasted about 90 seconds. And so they know from watermarks that the water got as high as 20 feet above the farm fields. So if you were out in it, you were basically in 20 feet of water. You might as well have been out in the ocean. And that's how 3,000 people drowned.
20 feet of water and 100-mile-an-hour winds and a lot of debris floating by. Yeah, it was hard to survive it at all. So it was a... Like you say, there was a racial disparity there, to put it mildly. In the end, they dug giant pits and just pushed all these bodies in and covered them up, no ceremony. That was it. So it really was forgotten at the time, but is remembered later in books like yours. We are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are talking with Elliot Kleinberg, who's a staff writer for the Palm Beach Post, but is also an author of many books on Florida, a serious historian of Florida, has a history column that he's been doing for 20 years and another one that's just come out. So we get to FDR and the movement toward establishing an Everglades National Park, which is really the culmination. And you'll see that I mentioned that the American Experience show, in that show, that's kind of the denouement. You know, the conclusion of the show is really the culmination of the whole thing is the formation of this park. And there's some key people there. One of them was a biologist named Ernest Coe. But really his protege, who was a journalist, is somebody that Elliot can talk about for a couple of minutes here. And we've mentioned her name already, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
You know, I had a couple of opportunities to interview her in the late years of her life. I think she was 109 when she died, and I would go down there and talk to her. And keep in mind that she started becoming a major activist for the Everglades in her 60s, when most people are starting to retire, and, of course, did it for another 50 years after that. And she came down to Florida to work with her dad at the Miami Herald, and she always joked that she knew she was never going to make it as a journalist because her dad would say, I sent you out for a story, and you came back with 3 sunsets. She came back and wrote about sunsets. And so she knew she wasn't going to make it as a journalist. And so she did other things, and she wrote this book called The River of Grass. And what had happened was, she was writing about a lot of environmental stuff. She wrote a fabulous book about hurricanes. That was one of the earliest explanation of hurricanes for public consumption. It was called Hurricane. So there was this group that was writing a series of books about all the great rivers of the nation, Mississippi River, Missouri River, Columbia River. And they came to her, and she said, well, there aren't any really rivers of consequence in Florida, except that the Everglades is sort of a river. And the publishers were, well, what do you mean? She said, well, it may not be a narrow thing, but there's basically a flow of water that goes through the peninsula. So it's this incredibly wide river, but it's still sort of a river. And, of course, she called it the River of Grass, which has become now such a well-known, iconic phrase that here at the Palm Beach Post, where I work, I'm not allowed to use it because it's become sort of a cliche. And so she wrote this book called Everglades River of Grass. And again, keep in mind that we had just had the 26 and 28 hurricanes, which had done tremendous damage both to the populated areas and to the interior areas. So it was a 1-2 punch. And as if that wasn't enough, we had had this 1935 Labor Day storm, which basically washed the railroad in the Florida Keys right into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So now Florida was deep, deep in the Depression, and they had had all these natural disasters. I'm sure what they had in their mind was that the only thing we should do now is just build, 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 because that'll get us out of the Depression. But then you had people like Marjorie Stoneman Douglas coming out and saying, well, wait a minute, these places in the interior, Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades and all these natural ecosystems, really need to be protected. And this was, you know, as we've said, there were bits and pieces over the history of Florida where people were saying this, and for most of the time they weren't listened to. But when Marjorie Stoneman Douglas came out and some other people started coming forward, and the movement kind of got some footing.
Yeah, so she was kind of, at least in Florida, it was kind of the dawn of ecology, and she sort of invented that, really, I think. Well, Elliot, we just have a minute or so left, but I'd say perhaps more than any other area of the country, South Florida on both coasts exists in balance with the health of the Everglades, and I think we've kind of talked about that, talked around it, and tried to make it a little clearer, but too few people in positions to influence things realize that, or at least act on what they do know. And so the baby boom is retiring in force now, and many of them are moving to Florida, as waves of people always do move to Florida when they retire, right? And there seem to be more and stronger hurricanes. So what do you think the future holds, just in a minute or so, for the Everglades and for that precarious balance between the Everglades and the coasts?
Well, I believe that you find that nothing changes people's minds more than when something that's abstract suddenly gets in their face. And it's one thing to hear about the damage to the interior and the messing up of the natural rain machine. And it's another when you seem to be having more and stronger hurricanes, when you have the sort of algae blooms that we've had down here in our area in the last couple of years, when you have sea level rise, when you have all these droughts because the natural water sources are drying up. All of a sudden, it becomes very real. It's no longer abstract. And a lot of politicians are finally, here in Florida and nationally, are finally coming to grips with that and are being called to task by the voters and saying, look, you know, we don't want to destroy the paradise. This is why we moved to Florida. This is why we grew up in Florida. Don't just keep talking about it. We need to really fix this, or it's only going to get worse to the point where it will not be the Florida that we love.
Yeah, we hope that doesn't happen, but it sure heads like a train toward that wreck, as we'll see. Well, again, the American Experience Show on the Swamp, which is the name of the book that kind of the show is based on, airs on PBS on January 15th. And I tell you, you can go to Elliot's website, which has a lot of this kind of information and bits and pieces of what Elliot has written and worked on over the years. That's www.elliotkleinberg.com. So it's Elliot with one L and Kleinberg in the usual spelling, KLEINBERG.com. Elliot, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.